Good morning, church.
Good morning.
It is good to be with you. And I was thinking how blessed we are to be able to move from city to city, state to state, country to country, and find people of like faith to worship with and share. And now, what a great time to live in, even during this pandemic, when we have the capability of making connections over the air. And still know that we're a part of something together. It's just an amazing time for us, I believe. Life's to-do list. I don't know about you, but my list would be a little longer than 1 and 2. I think I would need a little more space under there to add things that we might need to take care of. But that's my topic for this morning, and it's been interesting, and I won't give it away, but as we go through this lesson, it's been amazing to me, again, as it has so often happens, that some of the songs have fed into it, our comments, our study, even the communion, have all led into this same idea, this same principle that we're going to be looking at. We're going to be looking at Mark 12, so if you have a Bible and you want to go to there, that's fine. We're going to pick a verse or two out of that to really focus on this morning. But there's a lot going on. In fact, we just finished looking at the Lord's last hours on the earth, and now we're going to step back just a few weeks and look at his last few weeks here on earth and what that looked like and how that was going on. So in order to really appreciate all that we have, we need to have a context. So looking before Mark 12, a chapter or two, as you kind of follow all the events, same things, some of the things that I mentioned will perhaps have been in Mark 20, in Matthew 22 or Luke 20 or John 12, all record various events about Jesus' last week or two here on this earth as a human being. And in that we see that he raised Lazarus from the dead. There was a rich young ruler that seemed to come to him and had a desire to know. And Jesus looked at him with great compassion, and yet it just didn't work out. He told a variety of parables during this time, more and more as he approached this final period of his life. And then, of course, there's always James and John. They come and have a private conversation with Christ, and they want to make sure that when he gets really in his place, that they want to sit on the right hand or the left hand. Some blind are healed. He has a visit to Zacchaeus. At a meal, Mary comes out and anoints him, anoints his feet, and wipes those feet off with her hair. A lot going on from just feeling the compassion and love to being challenged about where he's going and all that's there. And then comes Sunday, last week of his life, and things don't slow down at all. They just continue to go on. He has a triumphant entry into Jerusalem. He puts himself upon a colt that had never been ridden. People come and are shouting, "Hosanna! Hosanna! The Lord, the Messiah, the King is here." And they're throwing their cloaks onto the roadway and the palm leaves. Such a great event. And on that Monday, he comes in and enters the temple, and then he goes back out to Bethany to spend his night there. And then on Monday, he comes back in. More things are going on in that very time. He drove out the money changers and created a real issue there. But at the same time, he healed the blind and the lame. And then he leaves again, all because he's concerned about how the Jews might respond to him if he stays in Jerusalem. So he backs away again. Tuesday and Wednesday comes, and he taught more parables there in the temple. He talks about a vineyard owner who sends his servants and then his son to try to gain back the vineyard, and all the servants are beaten and his son is killed. He talks about a wedding banquet. He talks about two sons, one that says he will go and doesn't, and one that says he won't go, but he does. And the Pharisees and the Sadducees, they recognize that this is all about them. Jesus is pointing his finger. He's thumping them in the chest and saying, you need to pay attention to what's going on here. You're the leaders. And yet, nothing. All they see him is a nuisance because he's in the way of their political motivations. And if they could just figure out how to trick him, how to have him say something that they can grab a hold of and make it so the crowd will turn against him, all their troubles will go away. And so, the Pharisees, with a group of their disciples, send a group along with Pharisees and a group called the Herodians, who were Jewish believers who followed King Herod. And so, they ask this question about, is it right for us to pay this imperial tax, this Roman tax? And they thought, we got him. Because regardless of what he says, we got the Pharisees on the one side, we got the Herodians on the other side, and he's going to say something that somebody can jump on. But he foils their plans. He gives them information to think about and to look at and to consider. And they kind of sulk away. And then the Sadducees bring this situation that I believe they probably used in every argument that they ever had with any Pharisee. Because the Sadducees didn't believe in a resurrection. So they'd say, we got you now. How about this? There was a man who married and he died. And he had six other brothers. And each brother married that wife. And then they died, but none of them gave a son. None of them gave a heritage. So in heaven, whose wife is she going to be? And I bet that question just irritated the Pharisees all to pieces. Because they could never figure out exactly how we're going to do that. And so Jesus looks at them and he simply says, you are in error because you don't know the scriptures, nor do you appreciate the power of God. And they again, with the former group, just kind of sulk away. And in the midst, there's this expert in the law. And he's standing there and he's watching all that's going on. And so he has a question. And it may have been an honest question or it may not have been. It's really kind of difficult to tell. But he asked this question in Mark the 12th chapter, verses 28 through 34, where he says, one of the teachers of the law, Moses, came up while Jesus and the Sadducees were arguing. And when he heard Jesus give a good answer, he asked him, what is the most important commandment? And Jesus answered, the most important one says, people of Israel, you have only one Lord and God. You must love him with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. The second most important commandment says, love others as much as you love yourself. No other commandment is more important than these. And the man replied, teacher, you are certainly right to say there is only one God. It is also true that we must love God with all our heart, mind, and strength. And that we must love others as much as we love ourselves. These commandments are more important than all the sacrifices and offerings that we could possibly make. And when Jesus saw that the man had given a sensible answer, he told him, you are not far from God's kingdom. And after this, no one dared ask Jesus any more questions. Jesus doesn't say that our lives will be better if we follow those two commandments. He doesn't say they're nice ideas. He says, you must. You must love God with all. And you must love your neighbor as yourself. They were not options. They were set there to see how they could all work this through. Love the Lord. Love your neighbor. Boil it down. Those are the only two things you need to do in your life. Simple? Yeah. Just 2 points. We can keep 2 points in our head most often. But easy? No, it's not. It's a struggle to know how to do that. So what is it? What does love the Lord with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength mean? And that's what we want to focus on this morning. 4 things. What does it mean for me to love God with all of my heart, to love God with all of my soul, to love God with all of my mind, and to love God with all my strength? If that's so important, how do I do that? And so that really then brings us back to why we read Psalm 16. Because at the end of that, notice what the psalmist says. You reveal the path of life to me. You reveal the path of life for me. Life's to do? Here it is. You want to know what it is? Here it is. In your presence is abundant joy. And in your right hand are eternal pleasures. When I can understand, when I can appreciate what God has done and what He's called me to, how He has called me to love, I will find joy and I will find eternal pleasure. It's not about circumstances. It's not about what life is here. It's about a relationship with God that supersedes, that extends beyond anything that we're facing at the moment. So, how to love God with all my heart? Well, the first thing that I thought about is it's a choice. He says you must, but you can certainly, we've had people tell us you must do something and we've chosen not to. So it must be something I need to choose. And I need to choose to make that commitment to God that is personal, comprehensive, and wholehearted. It is all of me that I stick in there. And because He says you must, He starts off with this idea of you must love me with all your heart. I wonder if He also is asking us to think about those things that we see and do. You know, it's pretty easy to feel this love, to praise God when things are going well. But how are we when things are not going well? How are we when we have a pandemic and it looks like life is never going to go back to normal? How are we when someone disappoints us? How are we when life throws us a curveball in our family or in our job or in any other kind of relationship? Do we have that feeling of love then? Do we understand what it is to love God with all of my heart? I'm not saying you have to be happy about the bad things that happen to us, but we need to see through the circumstances to the God that we're serving. He is the one that's bringing us hope and joy. Because loving God, quite frankly, is a day-to-day learning process. You know that. I know that. Some days I'm really good at this. Some days, just terrific. And then there are other days it's the pits. But that's life. That's what we need to recognize in ourselves, that there are going to be good days and bad days. And my job, my focus, is to make more good days than bad days, to continue that process. So more and more and more consistently, I have those days. And it is all about attitude. Paul would say in Philippians, the fourth chapter, verses 11 through 13, he would say, I don't say this out of need, for I have learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am. I know both how to have a little and I know how to have a lot. In any and all circumstances, I have learned the secret of being content. Whether well-fed or hungry, whether in abundance or in need, I am able to do all things through Christ who strengthens me. I can love God with all my heart through any circumstances if I so choose. That's what Paul's saying. I have decided that God is enough. Circumstances don't matter. And with that, I'm ready to press on. So as we think about how do we do that, questions we might ask ourselves. How to love God with all my heart? Well, I could ask myself, is God the focus of my affections? Where is He on my list? Where do I put Him? Is my love for Him warm and real? What does it look like? Is it kind of like this when you meet up with a friend and you're not quite sure what you want to do? You give them the old A-frame hug? Or is it more like this? You just embrace God with all you got. You make it a joy. How much in love are you with Him? And do I take pleasure in His ultimate worth? Because obviously I'm not looking at my worth, am I? I am not the worth. I am not worth the cost that I am. But when I consider His worth in my life, what a great thing that is for me. So, secondly, how do I love God with all my soul? Soul includes that willful decision-making part of us. Different from our heart, but it's a little different piece. It's the thing that lets my personality show through. My uniqueness. One translator said the word soul means to let my personality show through. No, life in the distinctiveness of individual existence. Big words from somebody who had a lot of degrees, probably. But I did like it. Life in the distinctiveness of individual existence. I am not going to look like you, and you are not going to look like me. We may have the same God. We may even have the same goals. But we're not going to look alike. Peter didn't look like Paul. Paul didn't look like John. John didn't look like James. But they all had their uniquenesses. And God loved them just the way they were. Loving God with our souls covers those times when we need to love God apart from our feelings. It's those times when we take the breath and we forgive somebody, even when we want to wreak vengeance. We just back up. We let that part of us move forward in that. Jesus would say in Matthew 5 and 16 that we are to let our lights shine so that others can see the good works in us and glorify Him. That's our uniqueness, our good works, how it's going to look like that. And everybody is unique that way. There are some people that you know are like lighthouses. They are there. They bring light to a situation. They bring safety. They bring comfort. They bring direction. And you just love having those people in your lives. But there are also those of us who are like nightlights. They're not very bright, but they're there. But the important thing is you need both of those in your life, not just one or the other. I don't want a lighthouse in my bedroom with its foghorn going all the time. That's ridiculous. But I do like to have a nightlight so that I don't stub my toes. And that's the way it is with us. Regardless of where we are, we have purpose. We have unique gifts that we bring to the world. So how to love God with all of my soul? Questions to ask. Am I willing to give Him my life itself? Sometimes I can give little pieces. I can give a quarter of me here, a fifth there, a half there. But am I willing just to turn it all over? To say, this is it. This is enough. All of it. There it is. Does my worship generally reflect my inner desires and intentions? And what I thought about that was, so many times we might find it easy to put on our religious face when we come into this building. But does that religious face show who we are down inside? My inner desires, my inner intentions. Can I make those two the same? Whatever that is, may people see my joy in every situation, not only here, but at work, in the neighborhood, at the grocery store. Can you find that joy? And do I love Him with my total being? Am I willing to go there? Third, how to love God with all of my mind. Loving God with our mind covers much more than the practice of just thinking about God. Loving God with our mind is our active component. It's where faith turns into action. It's where our love turns into action. It is possible to know and believe in the truth of the Bible, yet still fall for many lies of the world and Satan. Loving God with our mind means we need to constantly check ourselves. People say good things. People write good things. People can be inspiring in a lot of areas. But we need to be able to check with our minds. It's like we're loving Him with our heart or the soul, and now I need to step up and do it with my understanding also. But at the same time, I need to check my understanding because it's pretty pitiful at times. I'm great at making excuses. I can find reasons for doing the wrong things and make them sound right. How do I do that? How do I move beyond that? How do I look for those things? How do I avoid from taking shortcuts in trying to serve the Lord? How do I find those things? You know, we sometimes repeat phrases in our head or wonderings. We look at how a reaction happens and then we think, well, they don't care about me. Or obviously they're mad at me. Or, you know, that really sounded like they were talking about me. Without ever really finding out what's going on. But we need to use our brain in there. That's the reason Paul said in Romans 12:2, do not be conformed to this age, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind so that you may discern what is the good, pleasing, and perfect will of God. Use your mind to make decisions, but base it upon God's will in your life. Loving God with my mind means that I need to put the right stuff in. I need to read my Bible as often as I can. That's where we get information. I need study and repetition to get that stuff into my brain and keep it there. In Philippians, the 4th chapter and the 8th verse, Paul would remind us, finally, my friends, keep your minds on whatever is true, pure, right, holy, friendly, and proper. Don't ever stop thinking about what's truly worthwhile or worthy of praise. If we keep those things in our hearts, in our minds, moving forward, it makes a huge difference. You know, if I'm honest with myself, a lot of times, a high percentage of my thoughts are about me. They're self-focused. How do I get other focused? How do I get God focused? How do I change this mind to doing that? So if we think about how to love God with all of my, does my commitment fully involve all my intellectual capabilities? If I have an ability mentally to do something in the world, can I transfer that capability to a study of the Word or a teaching of the Word or a sharing of principles? If I have a scientific background and I can look at how nature works and really see that, can I bring that forward into sharing how God changes the world, how He put the world together for us? All kinds of ways that I can look at that. Is my faith fully informed, or is it biased, or is it a blind trust? Many of us have generations of heritage in the Church of Christ. We have this background that says that must be the right because it just keeps passing on. And if we're not careful, we can reside in that and get caught up in it, but we need to let it go. We need to know that God is interested in only me. The phrase is, God has no grandchildren, is really important. It's only first generation that come to Him. Only me. Not my father, not my grandfather, great-great-grandfather, or not my children. It's me. That's who I'm responsible for as we go through this. Is my mind trained to think of His moral perfection? All those things that Paul listed in Philippians 4 and 8. Those are God's moral perfection. The gifts of the fruit of the Spirit in Galatians 5. Those are God's moral perfection that He desires for us. And finally, how do I love God with all of my strength? So I put the stuff in my mind, but I've got to do more with it than just put it in my mind. If it's just in my mind, it's an encyclopedia entry. It just does no good. It's just there. So I've got to transfer it into something. I need to step out in that faith. Back in Romans 12, the first verse, he says, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, I urge you to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is your spiritual worship. He says, you've got to invest yourself, all of you, into that. My strength, my body, my actions need to be a living and holy sacrifice to God. It means I need to speak up when I see an injustice. Wherever I find that, I need to speak up. I need to stand on the side of the right. I need to care for the physically and spiritually wounded. However they are, I need to move next to them and bring my life into their being. I need to do the hard things that take a lot of effort in order to possibly reap something. And sometimes I might even have to do the good and the right thing, even when it doesn't look like there's going to be a reward, simply because that's what I need to be doing. Loving God with all my strength means stepping out of my comfort zone. It means looking out into the world and knowing there are people that are different than I am. How do I treat them? Do I see them as opportunities, or do I just see them as different people, not in my class? Paul would write in Galatians 2 and 19. I have been crucified with Christ, and I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. The life I now live in the body, I live by faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. It's not me doing that stuff. It's Christ in me that's making the difference. How to love God with all my strength? Do I strive to love him and serve him energetically? Have I devoted all my physical and material capabilities to him? Can I sustain an intense love for him, even under pressure, or when doubt arises, or when I'm not sure which direction I'm going? The important part, can I maintain that belief in God's presence in my life? So life's to-do list, love the Lord with all my heart, with all my soul, all my mind, all my strength. That's where we begin. That's item number one. And if we can get item number one down, item number two is going to flow right into it. It's going to be easy. Because you're going to see people as God sees them. In reality, loving my God with all my heart, soul, and mind, and strength is simply a response. The Apostle John would say, "For we love because he first loved us." If we can help you in your journey of love and discovery, if there's any way that we can pray or minister to you, why don't you let us know by coming in the front rows here as we stand and as we sing.